Good morning. Good morning. Welcome. It's so great to see you all. Thanks for being here today. I start with a question. You know, I love questions. So I start with this question. What are you willing to wait for? Oh my goodness. How did that picture get in there? I am so sorry. How did that? My grandson, he just shows up everywhere. Isn't he cute? See? Great with that question though, right? What are you willing to wait for? We had to wait 9 whole months for our first, well, we waited a lot longer than that, 29 years. But 9 months, once we were told my daughter was pregnant, and then this beautiful little baby boy was born. So thank you for indulging me in the pictures of my grandson, you know? What are you willing to wait for? Anything? Nobody really signs up to wait, do they? Waiting is hard, it's difficult. How many of you have been to Disney sometime in your life? How many of you loved waiting for those rides? No, no. I was looking and I was like, okay, so what's the longest time anybody's waited for a ride at Disney? And evidently there was just a change at Hollywood Studios. They took out a coaster. It was called the Rock and Roller Coaster, and they took it out. And evidently there was a 22 and a half hour wait to ride it before it was taken out. Anybody willing to wait 22 and a half hours for a roller coaster? Me either. Technology, anybody ever waited in line for technology? Okay, I love those heads shaking, yes. This is my area right here, you know. I don't know what year this was. Of course, it's an iPhone was released. The longest well-documented wait times for an iPhone, because we know nobody's waiting for an Android. you like that? It was a full week. A full week, 168 hours. Now, I will say, the longest wait was also in 2008. It wasn't even for the original iPhone. It was for the second one they came out with, the iPhone 3G. To be fair, I have spent my time waiting in line for an iPhone. Go ahead and go to the next picture. That was actually a photo I took. This was September 21st of 2012. The timestamp on it is 6:09 a.m. I don't do this anymore. In the early years, I might have waited for an iPhone. I'm much smarter than that now. Plus, they changed the time that you don't have to get up early in the morning to do it. So, anybody waited in line to vote before? Yeah, okay. Anybody had to wait in line for TSA? Oh, see, I love the reactions here because these aren't like, yes, I waited. Well, yeah, I waited there. Checkout line at the supermarket. We don't have to do that as bad as probably as much as we used to. Or restaurant. Yeah. I do want to know, how many of you are like me? You show up at a restaurant to be surprised that there's a wait. And there is a number, right? I mean, it's like 30 minutes I might be willing to wait for. 45 minutes we're going to Culver's or something like that. Anybody else with me? Yeah, usually not a bad wait at Culver's. So in high school, back when 1992, for those keeping score, 90, 91, 92, Garth Brooks released his first album. And he went on tour for his Rope in the Wind tour. I personally did not have to wait in line, but I had a friend who waited in line 1 week outside Barton Coliseum in Little Rock, not a great part of town, yeah, and got me a ticket too. So I got to attend that Rope in the Wind Garth Brooks tour. We end up waiting more than we want to, don't we? I mean, even this week, Jasmine and I went down to the Department of Transportation. And you know, they have this wonderful system now where you can get an appointment that means absolutely nothing. We show up at our appointment time and still waited an hour just to see somebody. I was reading online this week, it says the average person will spend 52 days of their life queuing, which is my favorite way of saying it, which is the British way of saying waiting in line, you know. And if you think back to the olden days, pre-2007 and smartphones, what did you do when you waited? I mean, now we automatically do this, right? You go to a waiting room, it's this. You see people in line, it's this. It's always that. What did we do before we had that? We read those wonderful magazines like Star and National Enquirer while we're trying to check out. Oh, that's probably not what you meant. Yeah. We might pace the room, who knows? We read the magazines, and God forbid, we might have actually had a conversation with another human being. I mean, you know, I get that. But what, you know, waiting is not often something we sign up for. It's not something we enjoy usually, but it's something we tolerate. We have to. We don't have any choice. We endure it, and we resist it whenever possible, because we usually see waiting as a waste of time, unnecessary, unproductive. But I want to challenge us today to maybe reshape and reform how we see waiting. Because what if it is in the waiting that the greatest transformation within us can occur? What if it's in the waiting that we can experience God in ways that we might not be able to otherwise? We're in this series. We're calling it I've Witnessed It. It's based on a song we sing in our modern service. And we've asked a few of our Ashworth folks to share their stories on how they've witnessed God in their lives. And we're tying it to the lyrics of this song, I've Witnessed It. And recently I had a chance to sit down with Dorothy and Harold Sue. Have you guys gotten to know Dorothy and Harold? Yeah, great couple. They've been at Ashworth a few years now. Harold is a surgeon for Mercy, a vascular surgeon at Mercy. We know that I think Harold showed up, and then he married Dorothy, and then she moved to town and she showed up, and we've gotten to know them and be a part of their journey, especially their journey of fertility. And you know, we're celebrating with them right now for a baby that's going to be born in July. And I got to sit down and talk with them, and these conversations are very open. We have a couple of questions, but we just kind of let the conversation go wherever it goes. And what I noticed in their conversation is that they've had different seasons of waiting in their lives. And you'll hear about this. And they found the waiting to be necessary and even beneficial in their relationship with God. And in the waiting, as I listened to them tell their story, I thought they really do exemplify these lyrics from the song, Your Promises Never Fail. Take a look.
I guess a really important year of my life was probably when I was a preliminary intern. So I finished medical school. I applied to residency. I did not get anywhere. So they gave me a temporary job at the medical school. And they said, well, we'll keep you around for a year. You can work. We'll give you, you know, some pay. And then you got to figure out what you're going to do. I remember I felt like a second class citizen. It was just hard. However hard the interns work, I had to work like twice as hard. At that point, it's like, you know, when you're suffering, when you really have nowhere, that's when God's like, you know, are you going to come to me yet? Look to me.
I feel like when people ask me about like, oh, you're having here, like, oh, God is so good. I'm like, it's not just about the end result or anything. There was the 5 years before that, and God did so much there. And then there was the 10 years before that. I guess back in 2012, I told God, my life is a mess. I was on a career track on something I did not want to do, and I felt so broken in a lot of ways. I was like, God, what do I do? So I went with the church auntie to go pray. I was like, all right, God, it's everything on my plate. Don't know how it's going to look like on anyone's normal timeline, but here you are. And over the years, I see God arrange things for me. I think I was 27, and at the time, I hated going on dates because it always felt like a interview. I always told my mom, like, I tried, you know, like I really tried. Like, we're just so quick. I was reading through the story of Abraham and Sarah, and it felt like God was telling me, Dorothy, whenever you force yourself to go on dates, it's like Abraham and Hagar. They're trying to make it work out. But that's not what I have for you. What I have for you is going to be like Abraham and Sarah. It's going to be in my timing, but it'll be perfect for you. And I thought like, oh, that's, but it was like a weight lifted off my shoulders. It's really comforting to know. And then I thought, wait, Sarah was really old when all this happened. And so like when I met Harold the time I did, it didn't surprise me at all because of my age or whatnot, because I knew it was going to be later. Same with having kids. I was like, wait, Sarah was really old when she had kids.
from my experience, nothing compares to Jesus. It's not even close. I know I'm kind of desperate for God every day, but that's because of my occupation. People don't realize that it's only like 1 to 2 millimeters is the difference between bleeding to death and not bleeding to death. So I think being a place of desperation and really knowing what to hold on to. And I think that's the other thing I really, really appreciate. I know I'm not very strong, but it's never been about how strong I am. It's the object of your faith that matters. And you know, I think I like to point people to that. And it's not about, you know, the fertility. Like, God, if you give me no kids, give me 5 kids. If give me like Brent family size kids, I'll take as many as you give me. But at the same time, may everything I do just be for your glory. I may not understand it now. And it's really hard, especially when you're in the middle of suffering or you're in a really hard time. Or especially in a period of waiting. That actually, I think, is what's the hardest, is a period of waiting and there's no answer.
Waiting can be really hard. Sometimes it's just so, so hard. And I see it like a repeating thing. And I'm just not talking about like a couple years or whatever. I started praying for my future husband back in high school. And I counted and I waited for 19 years when God said, this guy. And sometimes I'm like, God, I can't do this anymore. But I think it's also in those moments where God shows up too and reminds you that, hey, I'm here. Even if it's hard, I'm still here. I think it's just taking that time to notice it around and then knowing that God is there with you, even if it's hard, I think you'll be okay.
I just want to echo that. I don't like the word like miracles or showing up because it implies that it seems like God's absent until he does show up. But I think he's just there this whole time, except he's walking with us. He promises, I will walk with you. The only question is, do we walk with him? For me, it's not God not showing up. I'm like, God, let me just give you the credit. You've been here this whole time.
That's great, isn't it? If you know Dorothy and Harold, thank them for sharing their story with us. Dorothy actually gives us our passage for today where we dive in. She talked about Abraham and Sarah and Abraham and Hagar. And that story begins in Genesis chapter 12. It's 12 through 21 is kind of the bulk of our story. Don't worry, we're not going to read all those chapters today. The message is long enough without doing that. But you go back to Genesis chapter 12 and you find that's where God makes this promise to Abraham. It's a significant promise, and it'll be on the screen. It's Genesis 12, 1 through 4. It says, the Lord had said to Abram. Now, his name's Abram here. A little bit later with the promise and the fulfillment, God changes their name to Abraham, and it's no longer Sarai, but Sarah. So the Lord had said to Abraham, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse, and all people on earth will be blessed through you. So Abraham went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. And Abraham was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. What a word. What a promise. But as you continue to read, you should soon discover that this promise, this commitment that God is making, it wasn't a right here and right now promise. It wasn't, I'm going to do this for you, and oh, here it is right now. You understand that this is going to take some time. And did you catch how old Abraham was? 75. Anybody 75 or up in the room ready to pack up and move to a place God will show you? Not even going to tell you right where it is. And he says, don't worry, I got another fun surprise coming. You're going to have a kid. Nobody signing up for this? Wow, I don't understand this. You know, Abraham, he's 75 and he has no children. Sarah, they have no kids. How can he be a great nation without any kids? So the story kind of advances a little bit and we move 10 years later down the road and we find Genesis 15 and you find God comes to Abraham again, Abram, and he reminds him of the promise. Look at what he says. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I'm your shield, your very great reward. But Abram said, Sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless? And the one who will inherit my estate is Eleazar of Damascus. And Abram said, you have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir. Then the word of the Lord came to him. This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir. He took him outside and he said, look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. Abram believed the Lord and it was credited to him as righteousness. And then the story here at this point kind of takes such a strange turn. Now, let me qualify this real quick. Because they had no kids, it was custom that a servant would be your heir. It'd be the one. And that's who this Eliezer is. And that's why Abram at this point is like, what are you talking about, God? Everything I have is going to somebody who's not my flesh and blood. But then as we continue to read the story, you see that it takes this weird, strange turn. At least we would call it strange. Hearing what God said, knowing that they were past childbearing years, Abram and Sarai decide to take matters into their own hands. And so they're going to try to help God out, so to speak. And so what do? Sarah comes and says to Abram, the Lord has kept me from having children. Go and sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her. And being the good husband he is, Abram agreed. And we're going to find that is a consistent personality trait of Abram, just to kind of, whatever, Sarah, whatever, you do what you think is right. Now, I said, this seems really kind of odd to us. I mean, we live in an age where surrogacy is kind of a part of the culture. But back then, what would happen is this is kind of known and sometimes even contractually obligated. In fact, one commentary I read said there was a place in the ancient Near East where if the wife could not have children, it said that contractually she would provide the husband with a surrogate childbearer. It's like something she had to do. And so Sarah, Abraham, kind of looking here going, we don't know what to do. It's not like they're not trusting God, but they're thinking, well, maybe this is the way God's going to do this. Remember how important children were back then. I mean, it's kind of important now for us, but I mean, even back then, probably even more so. The family name was passed on through this. The family land was passed on through your heirs. If you were going to be cared for in your advanced years, you needed children to do this. But not having kids for them was quite a problem. And Abraham already thought he'd have to give everything to his servant. So they go ahead with Sarah's plan. And this is an interesting part of the story because he sleeps with Hagar, she gets pregnant. But as happens sometimes in life, even when it's your idea, you kind of have regret, don't you? Hagar gets pregnant. Sarah knows this. She begins to feel rejected. Maybe Abraham was showing Hagar extra attention. We don't know. But Sarah gets extremely jealous. Jealous probably also because at this time, the pregnancy was seen as a blessing from God and not having children was seen as a curse. And so here's this woman that has obviously been blessed by God. And even though she would have to give the child to them to be their heir, Sarah doesn't like it. And so she begins to mistreat Hagar. And Hagar decides, I'm not going to put up with this. And she runs off. And I'm not going to go into great detail in this part of the story. But the important part is God comes to Hagar and meets her in the desert and understands her plight and says, I hear you. I see you. He makes a covenant, a promise to her and her offspring as well, that he will be the father of a great nation. And he says, go back home. And she does. She does. So she comes back and the story kind of moves a little bit further. And we see that down the road that Abraham receives some visitors, three visitors to be exact. And for some reason, he's very excited about these visitors. So he's like, Sarah, let's go. We got to make some bread. We got to get some food ready. Let's go. Let's go. So he hosts these individuals. And we don't really know who they are, where they're from yet. But there's a turn in that interaction where they look at Abraham and they say, where is your wife, Sarah? And he says, there in the tent. And then one of them said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Now, Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Abraham and Sarah were already very old, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, after I'm worn out and my Lord is old, now I will have this pleasure. Then the Lord said to Abraham, do you notice what happened there? The men became the messengers of God. They were the old time. They said, why did Sarah laugh and say, will I really have a child now that I'm old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah will have a son. And I like this part. Sarah was afraid, so she lied. And she said, I did not laugh. But he said, yes, you did. Uncomfortable. But here we have again the promise reiterated once again. 24 years after it was first spoken. Did you hear me? 24 years after it was first spoken. If you saw in the video, Dorothy and Harold said something that we already know. We don't like it, but we already know it. Whether it's waiting for that job or that placement, waiting for a spouse, the pain of trying and trying to conceive. We know this, don't we? Waiting is hard. Waiting is hard. But we also know this. Waiting is such a part of life. But why is waiting so difficult for us? I think one of the reasons waiting is so hard is that we live today in an instant culture. Now, I don't think it was any easier for Abraham and Sarah, but I think it's become especially difficult for us. Our attention spans are about that big, and we have no tolerance for waiting at all. I call this the Oompa Loompa syndrome. I want an Oompa Loompa, and I want it now, you know? I mean, that's kind of how we live life most of the time. Please don't make me wait. Please don't make me wait. So we were talking about this sermon earlier in the week. Someone mentioned even the difference culturally that we've shifted to. That you go back to the time of the ancient Near East or even the time of Jesus, and how did you get places? You had to walk. And you can only walk or run so fast. And so you knew to get from place to place was going to take so much time. How exciting would it have been when you got your first horse? Or your first horse and buggy, and how quickly you would have gotten there. And now we have automobiles that take the time to almost nothing. And I just admit, I'm the Star Trek fan that is ready for the transporter that will just beam me up, Scotty. Anybody else ready for that? I mean, bring it on. You just think about how different life is. I mean, I am old enough to remember when we didn't have the answers at our fingertips all the time. I mean, your parents or even you had to buy a set of encyclopedias, right? So that you could go look up an answer. And I don't know, I never bought any, but my parents did. I know they were very expensive and they were just out of date about the time you bought them. You know, you put them on the payment plan, they came in 1 month, you know, one at a time throughout the year, whatever. I remember those days, but now I need to know something. Oh, there it is. Oh, need to know something else? Oh, there it is. Our tolerance for waiting is gone because we live in an instant culture. But it's not just an instant culture. It's an entitlement mentality. Not only do I want it instantly, I deserve it instantly. You want to test this theory? Put your phone, your iPad, your laptop, your television in a drawer in a closet for a week. Many of us would go about stir crazy because I deserve this now. I mean, I'm constantly amazed at the number of videos you can see online of impatient people doing the worst behavior to other people all because they feel entitled. Man, that attitude of entitlement really does come out sometimes, doesn't it? And that attitude of entitlement comes out even in our relationship with God. After all, look at what I've done for God. Look at how I've served God. God owes me now. It's easy to get there. We don't like to admit that. But I think even your pastor has been there on more than one occasion. Waiting's also not just hard because we want it instantly and we feel entitled to it, but also because we value efficiency. What's the expression? Time is? Yep. Isn't that a stupid expression? How much damage have we done to people by believing such an expression? It makes us look at people as objects to be used, even looking at ourselves as objects to be used, because time is money. And if I'm waiting, that's inefficient, it's unproductive, and therefore I shouldn't do it. Does seem inefficient, doesn't it? Waiting's also hard though, because what happens when you start waiting? Has anybody had those moments? I remember a few years ago, I had my first colonoscopy, fun times. They took my clothes, my phone and everything, and I don't know where they put it, left me with the gown, fun times. And I'm sitting in there and they said, they'll be in shortly to get you. It was one of these moments where I just sat there and I thought, I have nothing to do. You know, I'm feeling my age evidently now that I'm a grandfather. I'm old enough to remember reading the cereal box in the morning at the table. Anybody else? Because there was nothing else to read. I'm reading the posters on the wall as I'm waiting for the doctor to come in. What happens in these moments when we have silence and quiet and we're forced to wait? Do you notice? That's when the thoughts start creeping in. That's when the anxiety starts bubbling up. Those questions of doubt, those questions of God, the questions about who we really are, what we really believe. Did I really hear from God? Does God really love me? Does he really care about me? What will others think? Those are the questions we don't want to sit with, do we? And so when they start to come in, what do? Oh, we praise God for the invention of the cell phone. That'll distract me and let me watch another video so I don't have to think about the doubts that maybe start to come up. And here's, I think, the kicker about the waiting. We're really good with waiting as long as we know the outcome. But how often are we in the waiting when we don't? You know, it's like when you have a baby and you're pregnant for 9 months and you go to the doctor and you start off every 4 weeks and then it comes every 3 weeks, every 2 weeks, every week. And if you're going every week and that doctor says everything's great, no problem at all, all those visits, are you really worried? Not usually. But what happens when early in the pregnancy they go, oh, this is now a high-risk pregnancy? The outcome becomes a little bit more unsure. And we're left with the worry and the anxiety. Not knowing the outcome makes the waiting almost unbearable. And yet, how often do we really know the outcome when we wait? You know, it's a message like this that I'm supposed to turn and then say, so let me give you 3 tips on what to do in the waiting. But as you may have discovered as of late, I'm not doing that for you. Number one, because I don't know what they are. But number two, I know they don't work. Anybody else? They make good notes to put in your Bible. But when we're sitting in the waiting, we know that there's something else. So what do we do when we wait? I think what we have to understand is waiting is a great time to reveal what's inside us, what's at our core, the type of people we are, whether we like it or not. And it could be that it's in the waiting that we find the invitation for transformation to become more like Jesus. Now, if you look at Abraham and Sarah, you certainly can see that they did some things in the waiting, maybe some things they shouldn't have done. Like, you know, they decided to take matters into their own hands. How dare they? I would never. You know, they did probably think, I'll help God out a little bit. This is what other people do. We'll just do what they do. Did they doubt God's promise? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe they just thought this is how God was going to do it. Maybe, though, what they found revealed within themselves was a desire for control. I'm glad I don't have this problem. I wrote down here, and as much as I'd love to sit in a place of judgment right now and condemn them for what they did, I also recognize the desire for control within me. My desires, what I think is best, can be a very powerful motivator, even when it leads me to act in ways that might not ultimately be best for me or others. It's in the waiting that I feel that, though. That it begins to stir and it's like, you gotta do something. You need to make something happen. You gotta get on the stick here, Brent, you know? And that's an opportunity for me to say, why? Why do I feel this need to take control right now? Not only might waiting reveal our desire for control, but I think it'll also reveal a desire to blame someone. Usually it's gonna start with you. If it's me, it's gonna start with you. It's your fault, just so you know. We'll start right there. It's your fault I haven't received. It's your fault I haven't achieved. It's your fault that I haven't become what I thought or believed that I was entitled to. But when blame starts, blame is hard to contain. Can I get a witness? Because it can easily go from others to God. God, you said, God, you promised, why wouldn't you want this for me? And then we're faced with the question, what do you do when you start to feel like God has let you down? We long for a reason. We just want to know why. And so many times in life, guess what? You don't get that answer. Don't believe me? Go read Job. And when the blame shifts from others to God, there's only one other place left for the blame to go. Me. Myself. Have you ever sat in this place? Maybe I did something wrong. Maybe God is mad at me. Maybe I'm just not good enough, righteous enough. Maybe I just don't have enough faith. Churches have been known to say that to people. And God forgive us for ever projecting that God to people. Now, do I think there's consequences in life? Sure, absolutely. But what do we think about God when we believe that he would be the God that's just looking for you to punish you for something you've messed up on, to withhold a promise? As I thought about that, I was reminded of the story in John chapter 9 where Jesus and his disciples happen upon a man who is blind. And the disciples, you got to love them, right? I love their honesty. Jesus, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now, this is where Jesus obviously exercised great restraints and doesn't just turn around and smack these guys. But he answers their question and he says, neither. Wasn't the parents, wasn't him that sinned. And then look at what Jesus says. But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. And then Jesus spit in the mud, spit on the dirt, made some mud, put it on this guy's eyes, and says, go wash. And this man's blindness was gone. I think we need to remember John chapter 9 when we want to sit in a place. Now, maybe God's trying to reveal something sometimes, and I don't want to short circuit that. Begin with saying, God, have I done something? But if the Spirit doesn't immediately convict, let's move on. And maybe you're in a season of waiting for some other reason than because you did something wrong or others did something to you. The point of this isn't for me to wag my finger at you and say, stop blaming. No. It's simply to remind you that when we get to these places, it's a good time for us to ask, what am I noticing about God? What am I noticing about myself? While I wait, when the noise can settle down, is the best time God can speak to us. In the waiting, it's okay. It's even encouraged to sit with the questions, the mystery, the uncertainty. And boy, we like certainty, don't we? Yesterday, I was reading something online and it was talking about this priest who went to see Mother Teresa. And so he went to Calcutta and he's meeting with her, and she says to him, "How can I pray for you?" And he says to her, he says, "I would like clarity, certainty." And she says, "I won't pray for that for you." She says, essentially it goes like this: as you get older, you find that your certainty diminishes, but your trust widens. So she wouldn't pray that he would have clarity, that he would trust more. Isn't that a good word? It's a good word. It's okay to sit down, to slow down, to breathe in the seasons of waiting. Take time, look around, notice what you might have missed. It doesn't mean we curl up in a ball in a fetal position either. Live life, keep moving forward. I mean, one of the parts of the story we haven't talked about was when basically God drops this bomb on Abraham, where God says, "I'm making this promise to you, now it's your turn." Circumcision, 99 years old. Okay, that's a whole different ball game, isn't it? We can continue in life. We don't have to wait and just hope something happens to us. Keep moving forward, living life as you wait for God. We can do that, that's okay. Let's wrap this up. What I want you to know, waiting is a part of God's story. Think about the number of times in Scripture we see waiting. Noah waited 120 years for a flood. David waited 15 years to be king. Jesus waited 30 years before his ministry began. And the world, the Jewish people, waited thousands of years for the coming of the promised one, the Messiah. And Paul tells us that in the fullness of time, when the time was just right, Jesus came. And in your waiting, in the fullness of time, God will reveal himself to you and speak to you. And you know what? When you think about the waiting, don't we find ourselves now even in a period of waiting? For us, the clock is at 2,026 years, roughly, as we wait for the return of King Jesus. And the world, it feels like it's coming apart at the seams sometimes, and we wait patiently for King Jesus to come and heal and restore and to usher in his new creation. We are people of waiting already. Are you in the middle of waiting? Do you wonder if God's caring about you or forgotten about you? Let me just tell you, you're not alone. You see it in Abraham and Sarah. You see it in others. Sarah even laughed. And what's so interesting is as you move to Genesis 21, and you've got this whole story building up to the birth of this son, and then you have like six verses of Isaac's birth. Isn't that interesting? You'd think it'd be like this. Nope, it's like this. And you read that when she gave birth, they gave him the name Isaac. You know what Isaac means? Laughter. Yep. As we wait, we remember that transformation takes time. Waiting is a good thing. A baby's gestation, a human child, 9 months. What happens when that gets short-circuited? What happens when it's 5 months? Things don't develop as they should have, right? That's why we have NICUs. What are we trying to short-circuit when we might be trying to push along when God is speaking to us and saying, "It's okay, just wait"? Dorothy said it. It's not just about the end result. It's not just about the promise. We have to remember waiting isn't defeat. It's not a setback. It isn't failure. It's part of the process. And when we wait, it reminds us that God is on a different timetable than we are. And waiting deepens our dependence upon him, showing us more of who God is, that he is good and he is faithful and he is loving and he is caring and he cares for you. I was reading something this week by an author named Dan Wilt, and he wrote this. He said, "In seasons of transformation, God puts us on his timetable, and he is in no hurry. We begin to measure time in long time, trust time, wait time, growth time. Sometimes we have to lose time by our perception to gain eternity in our hearts." Isn't that the truth? We have to move beyond the idea that if nothing is happening, God must not be working. More often than not, waiting is not where God is absent. It's where he's most at work. We need to know that. Abraham's story, Dorothy and Harold's story, and your story are all stories of waiting at different times. And it's really not even just about getting what's promised. It's about becoming the kind of people who trust God, even when, and especially when, the promise feels far away. Let's pray.